Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, always here, every single...
I'm sorry, that's you Skype lagged out halfway through that sentence. We heard, I'm always here, and then we got nothing for 3 seconds. I'm so sorry, man. That was amazing.
Let's try one more time.
From the top. All right.
Hello, and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main. I'm always the host here, even if it may seem like I'm not, but I am. Regardless of whatever kind of Skype interruptions I inevitably will have. Joining me, as usual, my compatriots, Brian Brushwood.
Hello, beautiful people. It's good to be here.
Justin Robert Young.
Hello, friends.
Well, gentlemen, last we spoke, it was brought up that we don't have enough goblin news. And on last episode, you guys did touch on a money-raising project to try to do an exorcism to get rid of a goblin terrorizing a village.
Yeah.
And this may be a follow-up article to this, because there was in the Zimbabwe Daily, which is my go-to source for all news, there was an article that says, the notorious Cowdrey Park goblin exorcised.
Oh, God. Now, hold on. I thought up until this moment that goblins were their own species. But if it's exorcised, that would imply that secretly they're demon-controlled vessels?
Well, Brian, I think, you know, if you may...
Metaphorical exorcised.
Remember, we kind of stopped covering goblins because we realized that, one, it was a mistranslation of spirit, and two, that many of these goblin outbreaks were probably the local shaman using some sort of date rape drug on people, and it took a very, very darker turn. But people missed that, so we're back covering it anyways, because, hey.
Well, so what are the details of this exorcism? How did they get rid of the goblins?
So what they did is they brought in a team of Tikisimandas, you know, I guess that's probably Zimbabwe for Ghostbusters.
Yeah.
And, you know,
great on a euro.
Guys in proton packs or whatever, the locally built version of that. They stepped in there and they exorcised the notorious goblin by the name of Ernest.
Oh, I thought per our conversation before Weird Things, I thought he was going to be like Ernest Lover 972 or some kind of like internet chat room name.
Brian. Like, know what I mean, Vern? Like, Ernest.
Yeah. You're talking about the fantastic comedian Jim Varney, rest his soul.
I mean, did he go to jail next? Well, did he go to camp?
So, Ernest, one would expect a somber mood during the exorcism ritual, but Cowdrey Park residents could not hide their joy to see a hunt and killing of the notorious goblin by 4 Tsiki mantises.
Okay, wait, hold on. It was killed. Not exercise like, boo, goblin, get out of here. They murdered a thing?
Oh, yes. Let me get to the details, gentlemen. All right? And whoever – I feel skepticism out there. Shut up. All right?
Sorry,
it's
I'll stop.
The darkest version of the Ernest movies ever. And that's including the one time that he got the electric chair and wound up getting electric powers from it.
Which can happen. During the exorcising ceremony, the leader of the team, who identified himself as Venkman, or Mafia Kavera, is that it's pronounced locally,
it's not stance,
said the owner of the goblin failed to pay the dues of a certain traditional healer who was getting back at her by sending the creature to terrorize her, which, by the way, is one of Bernie Sanders' plans for how to increase the tax base on the rich. You went to seek for prosperity help with your husband, but failed to pay the dues of the person who helped you. He got angry and wanted to punish you severely. He wanted you to die a painful death, he said. Venkman. I'll just call him Venkman. He said, due to the hardship of the economy, people now resort to other forms of wrenching cells. And this is where we get to the cool part, right? After minutes of exorcism, the team emerged from the house with a scary creature similar to a rat with a horn and feathers.
What?
Okay. Let's.
Residents could not stop commenting on their different experience with Ernest. I woke up at night one day and found my wife acting like she was enjoying sexual activities with someone. I cannot wait for this thing to remove today, commented resident Tuliani Doob.
Oh my God, this poor lady, she's just trying to enjoy a few moments of self-love and to pretend that her husband is...
You're reading too much into that, Brian.
I disagree.
Another woman, Naomi, said she heard Ernest clapping his hands as she was bathing. I was terrified when I heard Ernest clapping his hands, saying I must hurry up and finish the bathing as he could not wait any longer. Some of the women said when they were being raped by the goblin, they were in some kind of dream. I could dream about sleeping with a white man, and when I wake up in the morning, it would be as if I was involved with a man, said another resident.
Okay, so this is actually, I mean, there's a fairly long history of incubi and succubi, you know, this idea that, sleep paralysis, you would wake out of sleep, it manifests itself, everything from alien abductions to the idea of demons sitting on your chest that, and you in that weird middle
ground.
Promises
of commitment.
Between waking and dreaming, you would have dreams of sexual congress or if a guy had a wet dream, he would say, oh, I'm sorry, it was a succubus came in the middle of the night and she forced me. That's why the demon seed got out. Is that what's happening here? There's just more of those same archetypes?
I think there are a couple factors involved. One is certainly the idea that, one, we need to be conscious of the fact that, hey, maybe goblins are real, and I don't want to, downplay what these people are saying.
Could actually be Ernest.
Ernest is a goblin, and he's done everything that everybody said.
Could be the ghost of Ernest Hemingway. He's sitting there with long-winded prose the entire time that he has sex with you.
In my narrow Western-minded point of view, which is actually is sort of a racist statement because it implies that empiricism is uniquely Western when it's not. Many other cultures have embraced it too. So, but in my paternalistic, narrow-minded Western point of view, I would suggest there are two factors at play. One, that there is an element of hysteria that it just starts where everybody, as you said, any kind of account or any kind of weird thing all of a sudden becomes, oh, yeah, I had that happen, too. We've seen these outbreaks. I mean, these things happen in Western cultures, too. Let's not be, narrow-minded here. Second, there's always, a village shaman or somebody like that is associated with it. And shaman in many, many different cultures is a euphemism for your local drug supplier. You see that here, oh, yeah, I have a shaman. I buy mushrooms from. He's a drug dealer. No, he's a shaman.
He's a spiritual guy. He gets me right.
You go ahead and anybody who is into some of the new age stuff that will tell you about the clarity they had during an ayahuasca trip, usually involves some degree of a shaman, a spiritual guide that leads you through this hallucinogenic experience, which is very popular these days.
Yeah. That's part of it, so that we always find these elements. And I suspect that many of these villages, there are scopolamine, there are these other kinds of drugs and things like that that cause a lot of these same symptoms, this paralysis system, and they're how people can be sexually abused. I think we may be seeing examples of that. I think we may be seeing people being drugged and potentially people being abused and it being blamed on a goblin, because a lot of times the focus comes back to, we've seen cases where people have then admitted to it, like the local shaman's like, yeah, no, I was the goblin that I made, hiding, his stash of whatever, like, yeah, it's the goblin did it. So I think that's a component too. I think it's hysteria combined with that. Or, it's goblins.
Okay, so let's deconstruct, because we have an eyewitness account, it sounds like, of killing a feathered something or other. What do you think actually got killed?
Well, it sounds like the reporter or there is – not to say that being – classically educated at the S.I. Newhouse School of Public Communications in Syracuse, New York, gives me any kind of journalistic high ground. But there are a lot of problems with this story that were I to line edit it, I would be sending it right back for another review. Very thinly sourced, and we don't know whether or not it's clear that the exorcism was done in front of the reporter, or the reporter is just taking the word of the shaman.
Might I suggest something else, too? Assuming everything happened in front of the reporter, as you covered last week on Weird Things, we talked about that there was a fundraiser to hire exorcists to go do this. This was a paid service. Cash money of the local equivalent was exchanged hands in return for results, and that result was going to be the exorcism. Now, we were had this skepticism about an exorcism because, well, how do you know? Like, oh, yeah, I waved my hands. It happened. But no, they had proof. The people who got paid had proof. They walked out of this hut with some rat-like thing with a beak or whatever. I suggest, I'm not saying, because I don't know what the how libel and slander law works there. I would suggest it's entirely possible these exorcists just made something and then brought it out. And like, look what we got, you know, their own smoking trap.
Oh, so you don't think that it was a when you say made a thing, do you think they made it out of like a dead monkey corpse and then they shaved
I mean,
it or
dead rat and a bird? Yeah. I mean, that's the it feathers and rat. I mean, they shoved some rat feathers in, or rat feathers. That's a new thing. They shoved some feathers into a rat or whatever.
Yeah.
So, all right. I guess that would be my next question. But, you know, heat's on you guys. You're of course, not like this, which was the actual exorcism of a goblin. But let's say you were to forge it. You know, what is...
I love the fact that we're so nervous about a tribe in Zimbabwe tracking down the Weird Things podcast and giving us legal guff.
It is the Weird Things ethos, you know, that you know, hey, maybe. But
until it's proved otherwise, we don't know. We don't
let's
know.
Say that you were going to forge it. What would you guys just go with rat and, you know, tape some feathers onto a rat? Like, you know, if you were to go the full P.T. Barnum, what would P.T. Barnum do to prove that he had just successfully killed a goblin?
I mean, it seems like in general, a shaved, because a goblin is a vaguely human-like item, you know, so I would say however you
Brian,
fake an alien.
Brian, sorry, that's your own prejudice speaking.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, bipedal is what I mean. I mean, are goblins four-legged animals? Or, I mean, you tell me. Maybe it's my Western bias that I think
they're shapeshifters, Brian.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I mean, they go on beer runs. They're the wacky quests in World of Warcraft. Their blast mages are okay in Hearthstone. But I mean, goblins are not
you're
most respected.
Your Western expectations on this, Brian.
I mean, elves are way better than goblins. Can we just say it?
Stay on target. You guys have to. You guys have to fake a goblin, Andrew. It sounds like by your high roading of Brian.
I think that it doesn't have to be that complicated. Just, you know, sew a bird head on a rat, shove some feathers into it, and then you produce it, and people want to get close. Like, oh no, don't get close to it. It's still stinking hot. Oh, don't photograph it because it'll swallow your soul. Now, we got to quickly dispose of this really important evidence that would overturn everything we know about Western science, religion, and the world before something bad happens.
Hmm. So is this Neshkam is saying in the chat room that they burned it. So is it just something where they could have had the entire village gathered and then they are at a safe? So after being paraded to residence, it was burnt. So you could just bring it around the town. It's kind of pandemonium. People are trying to get a look at it, and then you throw it right on a bonfire, and that's it. Everyone's seen it.
Yeah,
it's proven to exist.
You throw a little bit of granulated copper in there, so you get a nice green flame when it throws into the fire. I mean, that would be pretty impressive. You get some sparklers in there.
Play a spooky soundtrack, you know.
only you don't have a tape player, so you're like dun 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 dun.
No, it's not even a score. It's just like the old haunted house mix, where it's just like an old creaky door and like a singing saw, like
and a witch going, "Come inside, my pretty."
Here's the thing to think about too: is that we at face value, we can pretty much assume that somebody made a friggin' goblin corpse to just know these people over.
See, I'm surprised.
I mean, it's 2015. It's 2015. This is something they did in the dark ages, and it's still happening.
I mean, and to be honest, it would still work. You still get people forwarding old photos of the Fiji mermaid around, like, then explain this. And then it's like, yeah, no, Google image reverse search. Here's where you got that photo.
This also goes to just my general distrust for small towns worldwide.
Yeah, true. And Brian, and you brought up a very interesting point, though. If people know what a Google image reverse search is, they're not forwarding around pictures of the Fiji mermaid thinking that it's real. Like, you know, it's like, remember when you used to have to send Snopes to people that to a lot more often? Like, what about this? All right. you know, there's a place you can go to find out if this stuff is BS. Who, the internet? Like, no, here. Well, who are they? I don't know. People who look into this stuff to find out if it's BS, you know?
Yeah. Well, and in fact, Snopes did a very noble thing on a, I think it was an April Fool's Day entry they made. They made a completely bogus article about how Mr. Ed was, in fact, a zebra and not a horse. And they did it with the express intention of be all like, look, don't trust even us. If you read this article and you believed it, then you're falling for like we've taught you nothing, because just all you've done is substitute us for, you know, the authority figure that you had before. Do something smarter.
Science is a process, kids. It is a process. It's not a room full of people telling you what the facts are. It's not a book. Science is a process. That process does not stop.
Science is not a Facebook group. That's I want to make a Facebook group called Science is Not a Facebook Group.
Except for this one. No, but seriously, this one is where the real science happens.
Yeah.
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 Well, gentlemen, you know, it's not easy bringing you the latest goblin news.
Well, I mean,
hell no.
No, it's we have to wait for you to read all of the articles. We have to show up almost on time.
And frankly, if we plan on sending Bryce to Zimbabwe to firsthand investigate this and put microphones in people's faces and cameras in their homes and look into this, then we need, you know, we need your support. Scratch.
Listen, we got to buy him a ticket, because it's only with a revenue ticket that I can give him one of my United upgrades, global upgrades that expires in January.
Okay.
We're going to send him to Zimbabwe. We're going to get to the bottom of this goblin epidemic. But the only way that can happen is if you support us at patreon.com/weirdthing.
And I hear you. Some of you guys are saying, like, I don't think they're actually going to send Bryce anywhere. I think that they're just going to have Bryce produce a solo 30-minute long radio play, where, because they won't be able to tell whether or not he's actually in Zimbabwe. But you know what? Even if that is the case, even if we were hinting that maybe there'd be the equivalent of a Weird Things pay-per-view special, and that we get to follow the audio adventures of Bryce Castillo a la Radiolab, a la 99% Invisible, as he tracks down one of the most important cryptids in the history of the world, I mean, I'd kick in some bucks over at patreon.com/weirdthings for that kind of thing.
Yeah. Or we could make him wrestle a goblin.
Yeah, I think we could actually, you know, we get to a certain level, I think we do have that happen. I mean, there's one thing for us to have him go hunt it down. If we're going to have Bryce actually fight a goblin, which can take physical form,
yeah,
we're going to need to put him through some sort of MMA classes, maybe like rodent control. It'll take a lot of skills, but I think he can do it.
I could take a goblin. I think I could take a goblin pretty easily.
Oh, look at that. Now he's getting cocky. Man. About it.
I don't know, dude. I mean, said the man who has yet to fight a goblin. I don't know. I get a feeling that we're going to get some sweet, sweet audio of what happens when you decide what happens when goblin claws start grabbing at your chest.
Oh, you know, Spike in the chat room, make him have sex with the goblin. Now you've gone too far.
Yeah,
you know,
dude, that's the $10,000 level, guys.
Yeah, we're trying to have a serious discussion about Bryce Castillo being forced to go to Zimbabwe to fight a goblin, and now you made it ridiculous. Either way, go to patreon.com/weirdthings. Support this show. If we brighten your day or your week in any way possible, then we would appreciate that you pass a few ducats our way.
Yeah.
So, gentlemen, getting away from goblin news for a moment, I want to talk about a school closing in Zimbabwe. There was a gnashing of teeth at Shakaway Primary School when six pupils allegedly spotted a mystical, diminutive creature leapfrogging from one spot to another in the classroom as their teacher wrote an exercise on the chalkboard. Angry parents stormed the school on Monday to withdraw their children, saying the current environment was not conducive for learning. Well, no kidding. This was despite the fact that grade sevens will be sitting for exams next month. The Manaka Post gathered from pupils, parents, traditional leaders, and teachers that the alleged creature could be... Oh, wait, it is a goblin story. A goblin.
Oh, jeez. Zimbabwe.
Hold on. Wait for it.
That's an unfair.
From one point to another in the grade 5 classroom, parents were left convinced that the classroom was haunted following another mystical incident involving a donkey in 2013.
Okay, well, hold on. I do believe that there was an incident with a donkey in whatever year that was, but a mystical incident, like a donkey shows up and swishes its tail and you get lighter and you float or something.
I don't know. Although, well, to keep the theme, I wonder if this goblin's name is Pee-wee Herman.
The alleged creature had contact with one of the kids, and the child's mother, Miss Patience Mendoza, said the minor was complaining of a hurting ear and headache.
I mean, let's face facts.
Argue with that, Brian.
Minors are always complaining of... There's two things. It's earaches and headaches that they have constantly. I mean, you know what? This is all right, and my children, my house is clearly infected with goblins. Goblins, all right.
Well, let's look at what we have here. Okay, we've got a goblin that is jumping around from what was it, from desk to desk, or up on top of the building.
Desk to desk.
So jumping around from desk to desk. Disturbing the kids. All of a sudden, a panic amongst the parents. They're pulling their kids out. They got tests coming up in a few weeks. It sounds like this goblin is a menace to education.
I would say so.
He's just trying to liven things up. He's all like, book learning. Boring, right, kids? Let me, 2 + 2 = 4. How many feet are balancing on your head as I juggle these apples?
The goblin's like, well, when Robin Williams did it, you gave him an Oscar.
All right. All seriousness, gentlemen, let's move. I'm going to change the topic entirely. I want to talk about the latest Mars information. Photos. We've got some more photographs coming back from Mars Rover. And this is kind of... Oh, wait, what is this? Oh, it's a goblin head on Mars.
What? A goblin head on Mars. The aliens must be putting out their Halloween decorations. When did this come out?
October 16th, Friday.
Wow, just a few days ago. Wow.
If you click the right arrow.
Let's go ahead and get a closer look on that there, Nesh. Wait, okay, so look at the... Well, hello there.
I don't see the goblin.
So you
it's
got
like
the
a
eye.
My Little Pony. No, it's not the. It's no. I think he's more looking at us.
I like the. Wait, was that your drawing or that was the newspaper's drawings? I like this the fact that you're disagreeing with the source's interpretation.
Well, they go to another one where they show us an example of Watu and a Skeksis.
Yeah.
Oh, look at that! Yeah.
It does look like Watto.
That rock looks like it makes a unwise bet on Sebulba.
Either that or it chooses trial by stone.
Go to the next wait. Go next wins. After that, look in the lower left. Dinosaur skull.
Wait, this is what the butt?
That does look like a dinosaur skull. I'm trying, like my skeptic goggles just fogged up with excitement, and I can't see through them properly now because that's definitely a T-Rex skull.
And then further on, there's the magic school bus.
Okay, are these just all the greatest hits of like crazy stuff we've seen in Martian pictures?
Pretty much. I mean, yeah.
This isn't all new stuff, though.
No.
It's not like the Mars rover just like got bored and was like, yo, let's just take some pictures of some crazy stuff.
Well, I mean, in so many ways, though, like so many conspiracy theories are look at noise, find some kind of signal in the noise. And it's like, what is Mars if not all the released photos being like an infinitely – it was like if these were on the moon, these would all be proof that we didn't actually go to the moon. But instead, it's like, okay, well, maybe we did land, you know, probes on Mars, but what kind of crazy stories can we make up involving ancient civilizations or analogs to things that we see nowadays? Like Sebulba's head, or I'm sorry, Watto's head, or the magic school bus, or Skeksis.
Here's kind of an interesting one, is if you click ahead in the images, you'll see, you get to the Iron Cross.
The Iron Cross?
No.
Hold on, the Iron Cross was a symbol of the Third Reich, if I'm not mistaken, right?
It was used by other people before then.
Okay. Oh my God, that looks definitely swasty.
No,
it's a cross. It's not.
Looks a little swasty.
That's a cross. That's not a swast. It's a cross.
Get swasty.
It's not swasty.
Take off your pants and your underpants.
No. That's
Third Reich.
It looks more
swasty.
Like something medieval. Or the steering wheel.
I mean, it might be the glaive from that movie Crawl in 1982. I mean, it could be the glaive.
How many times do you hear that? It might be the glaive from the movie Crawl.
The only thing that survived that movie was Liam Neeson. Well, gentlemen, how do you explain that?
I mean, it doesn't matter. It's not on me to explain it. It's on them.
No, it is. I just asked you to explain it.
We just told people that we get paid, so we explain things. So
okay,
like,
fine. You want the explanation? Rocks be moving around a lot and getting tumbled and turn it into shapes.
Brian, your skeptic brain is reaching there.
Oh, you think so?
You're ignoring that this thing is clearly manufactured and made.
So you've got a
perfect sphere, perfect circle there. You've got another half circle there. It absolutely looks like a manufactured thing. Absolutely looks like it's something that's made.
It does. I will not deny that. It is definitely enhanced by the circle drawn around it. But there are perfect circles that occur in nature all the time. We call them bubbles.
With crosses inside of them, things that look like actual, like if this was the site, cool your jets,
Joe Rogan. Let me get finished. All right. There are bubbles, there are spheres, and then they create the things separately. We have a number of different things that create squares. We have, you know, salt crystals are squares, snowflakes. The reason that snowflakes are six pointed stars is the same reason that that ice crystals form. Yes.
Brian.
Yes.
Show me an example of nature of something like this, of something with this degree. Just the cross would be amazing. And then the circle. Show me a thing in nature.
I could show you something from nature that looks exactly like this. Bryce, please bring up the image on that screen right there. There it is. From nature. And it's exactly that. Because it's a totally natural thing.
You're so wrong. You're so wrong. Your tiny little skeptic mind's about to be busted because we know what it is.
What is it?
What?
I would love it if I'm totally wrong on this.
Type in you're so wrong. Type in an iron cross on Mars into Google as a search with a question mark.
Yep. Oh, it says debunked is the top Celtic cross on Mars. Impression from X-ray spectrometer.
The image of a cross in a circle on the surface of Mars is real. It's from the Opportunity rover Sol 3720.
That was my thought.
It's from the microscopic imager camera, so it's quite small.
They pressed the camera up against the rock to go look at rocks that makes contact. So that is an impression from a man-made object on Mars.
It's the screws,
So that is the imprint of the screw that is protecting the camera.
Okay. But in true conspiracy theory form, I just want to double down and say that I'll bet you somewhere in the world is a naturally occurring formation that looks like that.
I'm sure somewhere in the world there is a naturally occurring formation of our three heads.
Right. And in an infinite world of creation, you know, there is...
Nailed it.
It was the blurst of times.
Nailed it.
I apologize, Brian. I'm sorry.
Fair enough.
But that's a cool example of those something where we're going, and then we did that?
Oh. Yeah, I was going to say if it was – like that actually is not what I had thought. I thought maybe it was some sort of artifact of the camera, that there was some kind of reflection or artifacting like that.
Is this in some way a mega version of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, where it's like the very act of looking for a thing causes us to alter it? I mean, obviously, you know, normally that's applied at the subatomic level, where there's no way for us to detect anything at that level without banging, you know, pieces of it around and affecting it in a big way. But in small ways, you know, it makes me think of one of the classic arguments that we never went to the moon was that, oh, look, here's the letter C that's on this rock. Clearly it's labeled by letter, when in fact it was an eyelash on the film, you know, that that had made it.
Well, yeah, there's a reason, you know, we try to decontaminate stuff as much as possible, because one of the problems of when we send probes to other planets or moons is that if we find something, we have to really try to rule out the idea that we brought it with us. And, you know, that's going to be, let's say we find some sort of microbial or some sort of form of life on Mars. you know, there's going to be, you know, the suggestion like, well, you know, we sent the Viking probes there, you know, probably, you know, 50 years ago or so. And, you know, maybe we re-inhabited it or something. And then we'll, you know, we'll look at DNA or RNA analysis, whatever, to kind of get to the bottom of it. But it will never be this clear and easy thing if it's pretty simple.
Yeah, it's one of those things where it's like there never is. There's only a second layer of questions. You never get to certainty. You just get closer to, well, it's looking a lot better for, and this is a weird metaphor to bring with it, but it's like that was the epiphany I had about doing work in television. Like, let's say you have an idea. Your goal is to become a television personality. You start with an idea that you pitch, and then you wonder if they're going to pick up the pitch to do development footage. And then you do the development footage, and you wonder if they're going to like it enough to do a pilot. And then you do a pilot. You wonder if they're going to like it enough to air it. And then when it gets aired, you wonder if they're going to like it enough to buy a season. And then you buy a season, and then they're going to do it. Are they going to like it enough to do a second season? And it's like it just never ends.
No.
And there's never a congratulations, you're now a bona fide television personality.
Oh, and when we, you know, if we've ever find life out there on Mars, particularly, the question will be, well, did it start on Mars and spread to Earth? Was it independent? Because developing independently is a much different question. Because if it developed independently, it means the universe is going to be teeming with life. If it had to spread from one planet to the next, then maybe it won't be. And so all these other, you know, these questions, and all of them are exciting answers. And maybe we'll have an answer to that, because you know what happens in 8 weeks, gentlemen?
The Mayan calendar finally runs out for reals this time. This time the Mayan calendar's rage against humanity is
Harold
personal.
Harold Camping's prophecy comes true.
Yes, and the Heaven's Gate people will return. No, gentlemen, that is not what happens. If all goes according to plan, 8 weeks, mere 8 weeks, 56 days, if I'm doing my math correctly, SpaceX returns to space, puts the space back in the X.
Oh, that's right. So they haven't fired off a rocket since that one was lost, right?
Lost. Kind of pieces.
I'm sorry. By lost, I meant exploded into a billion chunks of rubble.
I don't have to be so graphic about it, Brian. You know, everybody has their mistakes.
Where is piece here? Number 797? I'm just asking questions here. They say it's not lost.
So they basically, you know, they shortly after, remember, Elon Musk said they figured out pretty much what they thought had happened. And now they've been able to remedy this situation to their satisfaction, enough so that they think they're ready to launch. And that's what's cool is that, you know, part of the problem is when you're doing a government program like this, even though long after you have an idea what happened, it could take years and years and years before you would ever be able to go back into space or get something going again. Because one of the things that happens too is the process to figure out why things went wrong. You know, with Space Shuttle Challenger, one of the issues was there were people saying, this is going to happen, this is going to happen, this is going to happen, boom, it happened. And then people are like, well, how did it happen? And it's like, well, we didn't listen to the people who said it would happen. And then it takes
Also, there's I think there's a big difference between manned space missions, you know, because of the jeopardy that you're putting human lives into. But also you have to separate, you know, the signal from the noise. I'm sure there were a lot of people shouting that they knew why the Challenger blew up before they were able to isolate, like, this is how it blew up. Also, this is the guy who was screaming it beforehand.
Yeah, I mean, it was the next day the stock, I think, for Morton Thiokol dropped.
Wow.
Do you know about that?
No, I did not.
That was one of these when they get into like wisdom of the crowds and what the ability for like predictive markets or predictive things, that there was enough speculation, enough people who thought, you know, in the aerospace, like, oh, yeah, this is the thing we thought broke. And so like Morton Thiokol was like the one stock that dropped the most.
Well, and also, like, even if you don't know why, I mean, if you watch the Challenger disaster in slow motion frame by frame, you could tell, you get a general sense of it definitely exploded on the solid rocket booster. It definitely happened close to the O-ring. You know, you may not understand why that O-ring went, but if you're an investor, you're like, well, I know who makes those O-rings, and I don't know that, you know, it's like, I don't want my money
sitting there.
You're
making no O-rings, no mo.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But you look at it, it's interesting. It was the stock that was hit the hardest of them all. Again, everybody's stocks, you know, who was involved in that kind of
Here's my point is there's two different things happening. One is the fact that these are not manned missions, right? Mm-hmm. And this is SpaceX's own money that they are deciding to put on the line. And one, of course, that of their investors. But they are confident in their process going forward. To me, it's an extremely important vote of confidence that they're going back so quickly. But, and again, we're all tremendous fans of SpaceX here. Let's just wrap our minds around what it would mean if they had a second failure in a row. How devastating would that be? And how big is this moment is what I want to know.
I mean, I don't think another one would be a good thing.
Right? But it seems like it would be considerably worse than the first one to me.
Yeah. Well, I think you would begin to get more sustained questions of reliability. I don't think it would kill SpaceX, and I don't think that it would preclude them from recovering from it, but it would certainly create a more, at least in the media and public perception, especially because it will be pounced on so much by people who are very actively trying to discredit them, you know, that like they are just not a solution. They are not a reliable solution for space travel.
I think that I have an idea. I mean, I have a little, I know a little bit kind of internally what happened or have heard things that happened and sort of why this thing came about. And, you know, the idea is that they've tried to fix that and sort of where these problems could kind of creep up. And then that moving forward, should something like that happen again, then you would probably have a big restructure.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think SpaceX would have to show, like, the bigger sin would be that SpaceX didn't fix the problem.
Yeah.
And that's something that, especially in rocket science, is kind of the only goal, is identify problems, because it's such a complex thing to do, and address them sufficiently, and then continue to look for more problems.
So this next launch is when again, Andrew?
Sometime in mid-December.
Oh, wow. So that is just around the corner. Is this because I believe the one that exploded was a ISS resupply mission, correct?
Correct.
Yeah. So, are we worried about them having enough to eat, or is this another ISS supply?
No, we have multiple capabilities of resupply.
We're not to the Martian yet, where it's like we're not trying to get them.
They got a Taco Bell or something up there. they'll be fine.
Yeah. Gentlemen. Hey.
So real quick, while we're on the subject, I would love to get your reactions to the fact that this week, all the people who had current generations of Model S and Model X Tesla vehicles woke up one day to discover the future. It downloaded itself overnight into their computers of their cars. And now all of a sudden they got autopilot on the highway. Press a button. Please, you know, we really encourage you to keep one hand on the wheel. But if you fall asleep, you know, we'll wake you up. And if you don't, then we'll slow down and, you know, stop in the middle of the highway. But in the meantime, what do you guys think of this? This is huge to me.
Musk told us this was happening. Musk had said when they showed autonomous stuff, he said, we're going to be putting the autopilot function coming in as an over-the-air air date. So we knew this was going to happen. And that's cool. He still says that, like, real autonomous cars are probably, like, 3 or 5 years away. Because they're just, you know, the really, really, really hard problems still haven't been solved, which is why they want you to have your hands on the wheel. Because if all of a sudden there's an accident up ahead and there are people trying to wave traffic around, or there's guys in red vests and stuff, or a snowstorm, or any of these other things, your car is like, I don't know. And Musk was complaining really too about LA traffic lines, because there are sections of highway, there aren't any. You know, they're so faded away, you don't know where they are. And if you're trying to drive a car, you guess where you're supposed to be based on the cars around you. But
right,
it's absolutely exciting that they're able to put a feature in there like this. He doesn't have cameras all the way around the car. There's a lot of functions that it doesn't have that you might find in a Google car. But it's absolutely amazing that he can add this sort of software functionality.
But again, like, there's, to me, there is one time that I'm driving a car that I am most tempted to be a little bit distracted and maybe focus on other things like the kids screaming or, you know, checking my Twitter or whatever. And that's when you're doing long distance highway driving. And this, I mean, it doesn't say go ahead, get distracted. It says the car's got you covered. And that to me says that maybe now is a good time to check Twitter while you're on that highway.
And that's going to be what your lawyer is going to use as your defense when you sue Tesla.
So, I mean, I think what this is just like the final boss shiny and chrome form of cruise control.
Yes.
Like, that and that's how you should look at this, and not necessarily as a completely autonomous vehicle. Although it's certainly, if you barely have to squint, it certainly seems a lot like it. All that being said, what I'm actually more interested in is Elon Musk, who, when he's not befriending Jesse Pinkman on Twitter, has a tendency lately to just go hashtag shots fired during these press conferences or interviews. He did it with Apple last week, and now in the press conference about the autopilot feature, says that Google's solution for using LiDAR in their autonomous vehicles makes no sense. This is a direct quote in a car context. Musk is obviously somebody who has very strong beliefs in engineering solutions, and to his credit, is not just somebody who gazes off from the sidelines. He puts his own money behind it and looks to be building the future in the image that he believes. But what do we make of Elon Musk taking hashtag big shots at Google's LiDAR solution for autonomous vehicles?
Well, and keep in mind, even then, he's like, now granted, LiDAR is great if you need a solution for, say, spacecraft, which we use LiDAR in my spacecraft company, but in my car company, it's overkill and it's dumb.
Yeah, I think, we're still trying to figure out, the biggest problems, I think, at this point isn't getting the data, the visual data, except in situations where, like, it's raining and others where you have low visibility. It's interpreting that and trying to understand, the difference between a bush that looks like a man and a man, and a parked bicycle on the side of the road versus a bicycle that somebody's about to ride out in front of traffic. And that's where so many of these human instincts come into play, where we're very good at judging. And highway driving is very different from neighborhood driving, too. This system, he says, don't use it under 18 miles an hour. Over 18 miles an hour, things are much more predictable. Goes into list all the different situations where it says there's not the full sensor suite that you would need for this, but that's when he threw shade at LiDAR, saying, I don't think you need LiDAR, but we certainly need more sensors. I'm reminded of, in artificial intelligence, it was like back in like summer of like 1968 or something like that. Marvin Minsky and some other people were really, really brilliant talking about vision. Like, we think we could tackle the vision problem in artificial intelligence over the summer. It was like a summer job, a summer project or problem to solve. And over, almost 50 years later, we still haven't solved that problem because we realize it's a lot more than just saying, that's a human shape, that's this shape, that's that. Evolution has had a billion years to evolve very adapt systems that are extremely efficient, using a minimal amount of hardware to figure this stuff out.
Yeah, I'm trying right now to find it. Here's what's significant to me. Like, yes, this is a very narrow application of this technology, but I would love to know what the percentage of traffic fatalities are on highway versus non-highway driving. Because I believe that because you're going at higher speeds, that's the most dangerous place.
Yeah.
But if we've talked about this before. People think it's going to take a long time for people to embrace self-driving cars. I think it's going to take 3 years of data before everyone freaks out. And is
our difference comes between how you and I will embrace it versus government regulations and everything else. That's my question. Where will they be? And again, it's there. We can say, yes, there's an incentive for the government to do this, but that's also, I don't know. I don't have the answer to that as far as, are the politicians going to say, yes, we need to make everybody buy this now. Are we going to just, is the first thing we're going to, it's going to be a complicated issue. I think that we obviously know where the path forward is, but getting there.
Sure. Well, I guess my point is it's freaking rad that, as heated as our discussions have gotten, like starting this week, hard data starts pouring in of real world applications of this technology and the success and failure rate of computer run, vehicles. I think is wonderful.
Oh yeah. And we have, and I would love to see sort of the data, because we know with, Mercedes has had collision avoidance radar built into their cars. I'd love to see some of the stats on that, to see that there's been, for a couple of years now, a lot of these little technologies incorporated self-parking and stuff, et cetera. And I think that, now with the Teslas and all that, it'll be exciting to see if we can get a lot more of that. Starts to get interesting.
Gentlemen. I mean, it will be a very narrow application. I mean, not, like, we love Tesla as a concept, and I'm sure if we all came into the money, we would all buy Teslas tomorrow. But, you know, there are only so many out on the road since they are a premium product.
Everywhere here, though. But, yeah. Gentlemen.
Oh, I mean, up here as well. But, I mean, like, yeah. I suspect not as many in Peoria.
We ready for picks?
Yeah. Yep. Hey, man, I want to give a shout out to all the fine folks in the chat realm and Bryce Castillo, who got me excited to play a video game called The Beginner's Guide. I don't think I talked about it last week. I think we did it after Weird Things. But The Beginner's Guide is sort of, it looks like a DVD commentary on a set of unrelated games in which the main character talks about how these are all developed by an indie gamer named Coda. And over the course of the games, you get hints about the relationship of this narrator that you have and his relationship to Coda and what he thinks the game means. And then you get little hints from the way Coda plays or the way Coda codes the games that indicate that there's a deeper relationship. And I was left with a very complicated opinion about this whole thing. There was it's doubly complicated because the game itself is written by the guy who did the Stanley Parable, and he plays a version of himself describing these games that Coda, a fictional person, did. So I will say two things simultaneously. The actual Davey, the guy who coded and created the Beginner's Guide and the Stanley Parable, has succeeded massively well in an artistic sense in that he put me in a headspace that made me simultaneously angry and upset. And there were aspects that I felt robbed of things, all of which I believe is something that good art can do. But the fictionalized version of Davey, I found myself mad at both the fictionalized version of Davey who's telling the story and mad at the fictional character Coda, who allegedly coded all this stuff, because I felt like both of them were falling short of their potential for different and ultimately stupid reasons. And it was kind of wonderful. I found myself angry. As a matter of fact, Bryce and I ended up speaking live on the stream. And then the next night, after having a full 24 hours to digest it, we ended up arguing even more, and arguing in that good way. Like, you know, is this?
It was a good debate.
We had a debate there. Bonnie was like, well, I think they're clearly two halves of the same person. And, you know, this kind of Fight Club argument. And I think it was an indictment of the relationship between publishers versus creators. And, you know, there was
too much.
That's fine. But I mean, there was even an uncomfortable moment that I wondered if it was an indictment of me personally and the experience I was having by pontificating on someone else's work. It was really wonderful. I highly recommend it.
My pick is Goosebumps.
The movie. How was it?
I you know, when I saw the trailer for the movie in the theaters, I'm like, this looked fun. This is really fun. Everything I saw from it looked really fun. And then I'm, when is it going to be good? Because, like, it's cool. Like, Goosebumps is such an amazing franchise. How do you tie it together in a film? Because, you know, the books, you know, they're fun books, but they're not exactly, like, rich in character or other stuff. It's just more of like, here's this crazy thing, here's this crazy thing, here's this crazy thing, and now it's done, and you're like, oh, cool, that was fun. They did a wonderful job with the movie. It was tied together very nicely. It was basically put together by some of the same people who've been doing, you know, some animated features, and it was directed by Rob Letterman. I think Darren Limke was the guy who wrote the script. The first few minutes of it, you know, when you meet, you know, the new kid shows up and they're moving into the house, really well written. Yeah, I thought the characters were extremely, you know, well done. I was funny. I'm watching this saying to myself, hey, you know, I could watch 30 minutes of this without even getting to the characters, because everybody had their own little, was very well defined. You know, and you get, you know, Ken Marino in a very small role that's pretty funny the way he keeps popping up that never turns anything more, but it doesn't need to. I thought as a script, it was a very well laid out script and a fun story. Jack Black plays R.L. Stine over the top, nowhere nearly as well as, you know, he R.L. Stine when he really shows up on Night Attack is. But it was a good version of it. Good, yeah. Not the canonical
version. A fairly performance.
Yeah. Never said, he lives alone. Poorly wrapped blunt at any point.
Yeah. Boo.
But it was just a fun movie. I got the end of it, was looking forward to seeing. I would see another one that did. It won this weekend at the box office. It beat Crimson Peak, beat the Titanic, Martian right now. And I think it's going to do really, really well. And I think that everybody should go see it, because I think if we have a really fun franchise based on this, it's great.
How Jumanji is it?
What do you mean by Jumanji?
I mean fun characters that you get invested in early in, swallowed up by a series of set pieces based on the creativeness of the things that are coming after them.
I think the characters are much more interesting. They're much more definable. There's a lot of funny. You really want to see the characters, and it's not about, oh, let's just cut to the spectacle, which is good. Yeah. You're interested in them and their drama. And there's some ham-fisted stuff in here. Don't get me wrong. There's some stuff you go like, man, if they fix this, and there are plot holes that I'm sure that there's scenes they took out for expediency that you'd go, oh, Jumanji is a very, very cold film.
Well, that's very, very good to hear, because that's when I first saw the trailer, that's immediately what came to my mind, which I thought wouldn't be a terrible way to rope in all that IP without, making it, super overly drawn mythologically to get there. But I'm happy to hear that it is more than that. I've heard a lot of really good things, and I'm excited to see it. And I think I'm really ready for the Jack Black feels like somebody that has always been so well liked. For me, and Brian, having such an affinity for him, from his work in the 90s, in the early 2000s, it's hard to kind of separate where his second act is, where the Jack Black now is. Is it in drama? Is it, you want him to be funny, but you don't necessarily need him to be Tenacious D, over the top, gross out funny. I would be very, very excited if this, it blew up for him. And it feels like a good kind of stepping stone for a second act for Jack
Black. So is it a fairly understated version of Jack Black that we see on the screen?
No. Oh, he's over the top. I mean, his everybody else is very normal and real. His R.L. Stein is, a cartoonish version of R.L. Stein. And I think it works good. I think it worked really well for that.
Well, yeah, and I don't necessarily think that he can't do that, because I think he does it so well and so naturally. But to do it in a family franchise movie and not have it be cloying or make you feel bad about it, like Gulliver's Travels or something like that.
Sure.
I think is very, very good for him. He will always be able to be the silliest guy on screen.
Yeah.
Because he's just that charismatic.
Yeah, there's a funny kind of exchange there where he mentions, how he sold more books than Steve King and that. And it just kind of makes you wish, there's like some great kind of, quotes there. Like, so 400 million books, more than Steve King, And then somebody's like, oh, Goosebumps, aren't they just, children's books? Are they bedtime stories? He says, no, Goosebumps are books that keep you up at night and terror. And then my favorite quote is, every story has three parts, a beginning, a middle, and a twist.
That's amazing.
A very interesting decision, though, to make R.L. Stein the central mover of that story and not invent some other thing. But I think it makes so much sense, because he was so tied. Like, R.L. Stein, Goosebumps are just two words that so well go together. And when we first started doing the impressions on Night Attack, it was just because there is that brand recognition, and yet we know so little about him beyond, whatever interactions we had on the live action television show that they did. So I'm very, very excited to go see it. And especially since you said you liked it. My pick is, I love politics. My new podcast where I talk about politics is called Politics, Politics, Politics. RSS feed will be up tomorrow, along with, hopefully, at some point this week, I'll have my big review of the Democratic debate. But we did get the first, I think, big, the big political debate sketches on Saturday Night Live. So my pick this week is the cold open for this week's Saturday Night Live featuring Kate McKinnon's Hillary Clinton, which for my money is maybe the best political impression that Saturday Night Live has produced since Will Ferrell's George W. Bush, along with Larry David as Bernie Sanders in a surprise cameo, where he is basically not doing an impression of Bernie Sanders, but rather just doing Larry David shtick, which is just
inherently close enough to Bernie Sanders.
It's just so close enough that and really it breaks down what I think was missing for all of their Obama impressions. Both Jay Farrow and Portlandia guy whose name escapes me was that they
Fred Armisen
were never really able to hone in on the thing behind the facade, right? And all politicians have a facade. And so with Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders in the sketch, you see, you know, Hillary Clinton, which is Kay McKinnon's Hillary Clinton is amazing in that it's like she is over prepared. She is not a real human being. You know, her first line in the sketch is, "I think you're all going to really enjoy the version of me that my staff and I have created for you tonight." which is just brilliant. And, the Bernie Sanders, which is like, yeah, we just look at Bernie Sanders and we think he's Larry David. And you know, he just does Larry David shtick, like, where should I rest my elbows on this lectern? Which is just super funny. And it's Saturday Night Live is never better than they are during political seasons. Some are better than others. And I'm very much looking forward to this one, especially based on the cold open. So that would be my pick, is go watch that because it's super funny.
Right on.
Yeah, it's with sometimes like some of the political impressions, particularly both the ones with Obama, was like they were afraid to cut too deeply. You know, they wanted to still go to the press dinners or whatever like that and kind of be warmly greeted. Where with Hillary, yeah, there's so much out there on the surface of her that it's
where they can do a very incisive impression and still have her come on. Like, yeah. And which is almost informs the impression even more that she does not register these feelings. And then, like, you know, she is here to play along with the joke because that gets the demo pumped.
Yeah.
I think everything they've done so far is great. And Kay McKinnon is just killing it. That impression just slays me every time.
Gentlemen.
Yes.
It's been strange.
No.
Stop.
No.
Come on.
You didn't see that twist coming.
Yeah, there was a beginning, a middle, and a twist. Come on, give it to us. You gotta take us home, buddy.
It's been weird.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.